University, worldharvestfoods.com on the web, and 217-356-4444 by phone. See if they have an item that you want. They do catering. They have a dine-in area. And it's time for me to go. It's past time. 359-9338. I don't know why I said that. This is WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored and volunteer-operated radio.
Welcome, folks, to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air by WEFT, listener-supported community radio station, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois, and webcasting live worldwide at WFT.org. Views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers, do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of the station manager, board of directors, or Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Bob with some underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, call them at 217-328-2295. And the Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio. And programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour.
Okay, thank you, Bob. And speaking of Bill Faber, I just talked to him the other day on the phone, and we're going to get him in here to the studio for an interview in December. And he's going to be talking a little bit of combination of certain laws in the state of Illinois that act as barriers for justice, for, you know, rather, you know, basic ordinary working people when they have to go to court. There's certain things that sort of protect corporations, and also a little bit of just some, you know, kind of practical legal advice on the air as well. So anyway, and also some other upcoming shows. We're going to be having Dr. Margaret Flowers interview coming up here in about a week or so.
That on telephone?
Yes, on the telephone. Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd be nice to get her in here in person, of course. And who knows, we might be able to pull that off sometime in the future.
Might talk to Kevin Zeese sometime,
too. Kevin Zeese would be another good one, yes. Yes, indeed. And, of course,
You know how he started out?
No, huh?
National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws.
Oh, how interesting. Okay. Yeah. But anyway, we're going to start with some news stories, starting with Bob.
All right. The Senate on Thursday approved a ban on discrimination in the workplace based on sexual orientation and gender identity, voting 64-32 in a bipartisan show of support that is rare for any social issue. It was the first time in the institution's history that it had voted to include gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people in the country's non-discrimination law. Despite initial wariness among many Republicans about the bill, 10 of them voted with 54 members of the Democratic majority to approve the measure. But nothing's guaranteed in the House, where Speaker John Boehner has repeatedly said he opposes the bill. President Obama hailed the Senate action and urged House Republican leaders to bring the bill to the floor for a vote. Senator Harry Reid, the majority leader, said on Thursday that the time has come for Congress to pass a federal law that ensures all citizens, regardless of where they live, can go to work not afraid of who they are. He noted that a vast majority of Americans already think such a law is in place. Well, it isn't already the law, he added. Let's do what the American people think already exists. So Senate Republicans who voted against the bill known as the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, or ENDA, E-N-D-A, were muted in their opposition. The first senator to rise and speak against the bill on the floor all week was Dan Coats of Indiana, who said Thursday morning that religious freedoms were at risk despite the bill's broad exemption for religious institutions. So the bill includes a number of protections for religious entities. That includes churches, synagogues, and mosques that are expressly religious in nature.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
I don't know. This is probably outside this story, but the existing law as it applies to women, older people, racial minorities, and religious minorities, can the Mormons say that we won't hire black people? Or, yeah, I mean, not to smear the Mormons, but they did have a little thing where they didn't really accept black people there for
a long time. Yeah, that's a good question, Bill.
I don't know, Bill.
You know, or is it just gay people?
That's a very good question.
Can you say, you know, that you won't hire, of course, you know, you wouldn't have women priests at this point. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, for other situations, like, you know, the person who works in the office at the church.
Mm-hmm. Well, I could say that legally they can't.
The receptionist.
Yeah, that would definitely be a violation of the, you know, the civil rights. I think it's Title 4, Title 6 or something. You know, that discrimination against race or, you know, creed or whatever. But, however you feel about, you know, the whole gay marriage issue, I mean, you got to hand it to these gay activists. I mean, they get what they want. Organized labor could take, the leadership of organized labor could take a real lesson from them. I mean, they push and push and push, and they don't compromise, and they keep pushing and pushing until they get what they want. And, you know, more power to them. I mean,
well, Dave, 10 years ago, I couldn't imagine,
yes,
you know, same-sex yes, marriage.
Absolutely.
It just was beyond my thinking. It's not that I...
opposed to it. It's just that you'd never believe that it would actually become a law, you know.
Yeah, and you know, and actually 10 years ago I wasn't aware of global warming either.
Yeah,
which mm-hmm. is, you know, I it just blows my mind that I wasn't more aware of that.
Yes.
For longer.
Indeed. It does say here that 21 states and the District of Columbia have laws prohibiting workplace discrimination based on sexual orientation.
Okay.
While 17 states and the district also bar discrimination based on gender identity. But like you say, this is the first federal law that they're passing on gender equality.
Well, and is there any statement here? I mean, apparently that they got this done without unions,
mm-hmm.
and it's an employment issue.
Good point, Bill. Good point.
You know, it's I don't know. There maybe there was support somewhere mm-hmm. out of the labor movement, but it's not, I haven't seen it.
Yes.
You know, so that's all I can say. Yeah. It's not wasn't mentioned in this story. So
mm-hmm. no, okay. no.
All right, from Los Angeles, surrounded by about 100 police officers in riot gear and a helicopter circling above, more than 50 Walmart workers and supporters were arrested in downtown Los Angeles Thursday night as they sat in the street protesting what they call the retailers' poverty wages. Organizers said it was the largest single act of civil disobedience in Walmart's 50-year history. 54 arrestees with about 500 protesting Walmart workers, clergy, and supporters cheering them on demonstrated outside LA's Chinatown Walmart. Those who refused police orders to clear the street after their permit expired were arrested without incident. Those who failed to post the $5,000 bail would be jailed overnight. Their primary demand of Walmart, pay every full-time worker at least $25,000 a year. Of course, I question then how many hours they'd be required to work, but I understand the general demand here. One of the protesting Walmart workers, Anthony Goitia, a 31-year-old father of two, said he believes he'll make about $12,000 this year. Wow, in Los Angeles, no less. It's a daily struggle, he said, to make sure my family doesn't go hungry. Goitia was one of several dozen Walmart workers in Southern California who went on strike Wednesday and Thursday, calling for an end to low wages, unpredictable part-time hours, and retaliation for speaking out. They were joined by other employees on their days off. The strike protests and arrests are the latest in a series of worker actions across the country coordinated by Our Walmart, an advocacy organization with ties to the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. The strike and protests in Los Angeles this week are the first in what organizers said would be a series of protests leading into the holiday shopping season. Protesters said Walmart can afford to pay every worker at least $25,000 a year, pointing to Walmart's $17 billion profit from the latest year and the founding Walton family's fortune, which equals the wealth of the bottom 42% of American families. Walmart CEO Bill Simpson disclosed in a presentation recently.
Yeah, and guess where that money comes from? The bottom 42% of American families.
Indeed, with almost all their products coming from China and other sweatshop hells from around the lesser developed world. But anyway, even their American flags, ironically. Anyway, pointing to Walmart, okay, then recently Walmart CEO Bill Simpson disclosed in a presentation that 475,000 Walmart workers are paid more than $25,000 a year. Well, that leaves roughly 825,000 Walmart workers earning less than $25,000 a year. House Democrats seeking to boost the federal minimum wage from $7.25 to $10.10 per hour have criticized Walmart for its low wages. You know, really need to be about a $15 per hour the minimum wage, especially in metropolitan areas like, you know, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles. But anyway. This worker here, Mr. Goitia, was quoted as saying, "Where is the American economy going if we all work at poverty wages? There will be no working class. We'll all be in a poverty class."
Yeah. I got
the sound of silence.
Yeah. I got another story here from Mike Elk.
Oh, yeah, and, great. I like him from In These Times.
Working In These Times, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he's once again on the what's happening down there in Metropolis, Illinois at the Honeywell plant down
there. Oh, yes, yes.
You know, on Monday, a Nuclear Regulatory Commission, NRC team, arrived at Honeywell's Metropolis, Illinois uranium conversion plant to do a routine week-long inspection. Recently, workers at the plant have alleged that the employee refrigerator in the control room of the main processing building has repeatedly tested positive for dangerous levels of uranium. But because Honeywell will not allow a qualified union worker to accompany NRC representatives on their inspections if the workers are on layoff, the union claims that the company is putting them and the local community at risk. So during the last few years, the plant has faced problems with federal authorities over a series of safety issues. In March 2011, after an investigation by the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, Honeywell pleaded guilty to one felony offense for knowingly storing hazardous radioactive waste without a permit in violation of the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, RCRA, and paid an $11.9 million fine to the federal government. 2 months later, OSHA officially cited the company for 17 serious violations for the accidental release of toxic hydrogen fluoride, HF gas, directly into the atmosphere outside of the plant in December 2010. Members of the United Steelworkers Local 7-699, which represent workers at the Metropolis plant, claim that having a specifically designated worker represent during inspections was key to at least some of the company's citations in 2011. When workers found out that the union's elective representative, USW Local 7-699 President Stephen Leck, would not be allowed to go in on the NRC inspections because he is on what the union labels a punitive layoff, they were outraged. As union president, they say Leck talks to more members of the union and has a more in-depth knowledge of safety issues than anyone else. So, as the union representative, Leck had hoped to speak with NRC inspectors directly about the safety risk Honeywell employees face at the workplace. He says the most egregious examples have been in the aforementioned company refrigerator located in the feed material building where approximately 20 people work in uranium processing. In weekly tests mandated by Honeywell, he says that the refrigerator has routinely yielded positive results for dangerous levels of uranium contamination, and long-term exposure to uranium, as the EPA points out, can lead to liver damage and internal irradiation and increased risk of cancer. Now, when OSHA was doing an inspection at the same plant, they allowed the president, Stephen Leck, to accompany them, but the NRC is refusing, saying that if Honeywell refuses, the NRC won't let this guy in the plant, although he's the president of the United Steelworkers Local down there.
Who's the CEO or owner of that plant? We had a lot of stories on this a while back, I remember.
Dan Cote, is that the gentleman's name?
Dave Cote or Dan Cote?
Dave Cote.
Dave Cote.
C-O-T-E.
Yeah, I guess he's a friend and a big contributor to Barack Obama, too. So
yeah, he was
imagine
on his,
that, huh?
He was on his labor council or something like that
yes.
for a while.
Yeah. Yes, the austerity yeah. labor council.
Yes.
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 Yes, that's. I forgot about that fact. Thank you, Bob.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So that continues down there in Metropolis.
Wow. And that's right on the Ohio River, too. You know, that's what's really scary.
Yeah. Fukushima.
Yeah. You know, I mean, they've been feuding with them workers down there for years. It's just ridiculous, you know. And I believe they are still the only uranium processing plant in the country that does what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But they're sure not very worker-friendly down there.
To say the least. Okay, we're going to play a quick segment here from Workers Independent News. Bob, can you give a little background to this?
Well, they touch on a few different topics, the mm-hmm. Walmart thing, the mm-hmm. Enda thing that I was talking about. But at the end, they mentioned that without some emergency funding, they're going to have to go off the air as of next Friday, November 15th will be their last broadcast.
Oh, wow.
For Daily Workers Independent News.
Okay. All right, we're going to play a segment of this, and then we'll be right back with some public service announcements. And then we're going to be talking with our guest, Professor Dan Gilbert, about his new book. So stay tuned. Thank you.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The U.S. Senate has passed the Employer Non-Discrimination Act, which would make it illegal for employers to discriminate against workers based on sexual orientation or gender status. Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan.
Two-thirds of the people in the country support it. 56% of Republicans support it. But as you can imagine, in the House, you know, with the Tea Party influence, it's going to be a little tougher sell. We can try to work for the rest of the session to try to get it through our House.
Los Angeles Walmart workers, joined by hundreds of community supporters, went on strike Wednesday, demanding an end to the company's illegal retaliation against workers pushing for higher pay, full-time work, and the right to form a union. The workers say Walmart is aggressively and illegally firing and disciplining workers for taking action for better jobs. The recent disclosure by Walmart CEO Bill Simon that as many as 825,000 Walmart workers make less than $25,000 a year helped spur the strike action in Los Angeles. As the state moves to overrule the city of Milwaukee is battling for home rule authority when it comes to city residency requirements for city employees. Jesse Russell reports.
Milwaukee, Wisconsin has had a residency law for city employees for 75 years, but a state law passed in June of this year would end that rule. The city has called on the power of home rule authority in an effort to block the law from going into effect. On Monday, the
We think you should know the early warning signs of fascism. Powerful and continuing nationalism, disdain for human rights, identification of enemies / scapegoats as a unifying cause, supremacy of the military, rampant sexism, controlled mass media, obsession with national security, religion and government are intertwined, corporate power is protected, labor power is suppressed, disdain for intellectuals and the arts, obsession with crime and punishment, rampant cronyism and corruption, fraudulent elections. The early warning signs of fascism.
Okay, all right. Well, is it Mussolini's quote, basically, the fascism being the merger of the corporate and the state all in one? Basically, the corporate state?
That's true.
Okay. All right. Interesting little public service announcement there, Bill. And I think early warning signs are good to know. Okay.
Well, I was thinking of the old, when I was a kid, they always had the cancer one.
Oh, okay.
You know, the molar thing that won't heal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it was Burgess Meredith used to do it. I don't know.
Okay.
I was thinking more about the duck and cover stuff.
The duck and cover from the Cold War, yeah.
Yeah, when I was in grade school, I used to go out in the hallway and
face the lockers, yeah. I remember that.
Yeah.
Okay, some public service announcements here. The Untouchables MCs presents a pre-Thanksgiving concert starring legendary Mr. Lee and Company. That's Saturday, November 16th. That's a week from today. And that's over in Danville, 106 Commercial Street. Advance tickets are $10 and $15 at the door. It's featuring Jenny Holiday, Sydney, Joe Quayles, New Orleans Bow, Source One Band, and many more. So again, that's a pre-Thanksgiving concert in Danville a week from today, from starting at 9 o'clock. That's at 106 Commercial Street, Danville, Illinois. And I guess one of the caterers there is going to be Untouchable Motor Club, presents Sony's Rib Supreme and bringing it back barbecue catering service. We've got quite a menu here. And also, I want to let everyone know that there is a master planning process for the redevelopment of Bristol Park neighborhood in Champaign, which was kicked off on Thursday, October 24th, with the Bristol Place Steering Committee. This past summer, City Council approved a contract with FAR Associates, a planning design consulting firm in Chicago, to help the city and steering committee create a vision for how Bristol Place neighborhood can be redeveloped once acquisition and relocation of the residents' efforts are complete. The consultant met with the steering committee as well as conducted stakeholder interviews with seven different groups, totaling 35 individuals with broad representation interests. This include the youth of the neighborhood, as high school students from Centennial and Central were interviewed. Specialist project is the consideration of redevelopment, Bristol Place being certified with the U.S. Green Building Council. Anyway, there's a lot more involved in this. I mean, we're talking about a gentrification of a neighborhood here, and there's a lot of concerns with the residents there as far as, you know, how, where, and everything else as far as the relocation, especially since a lot of the residents own their own homes and many of them are renters. It's kind of a pretty mixed neighborhood in that regard. But anyway, a broader Bristol Park neighborhood will have a chance to participate in a community input event on November 21st from 6 to 8 p.m. at Booker T. Washington School. So turn out for that. I think even if you don't live in Bristol Park, I think it's good for citizens to show up and kind of see what's going on, because it could be you next. Don't forget that. Okay. Anyway, there's a film called The Dark Side of Chocolate about child labor that goes on in the cocoa fields in many countries. It's a film that'll be shown at the Unitarian Universalist Church at 309 West Green, Urbana at 6:30 Thursday, November 14th. Through Global Exchange, many are trying to encourage chocolate companies like Hershey's to not use cocoa from farmers who continue to use child labor, which is sometimes slavery. Come join our discussion, join our campaign for peace in the chocolate fields and for children and against child labor. That's at 309 West Green, Urbana, and at the Universalist Church, Thursday, November 14th at 6:30. Also today, tune in at 2 to 3 p.m. for None Other Sports Show, hosted by fellow worker Neil Parthen. That's on 104.5 FM WRFU and broadcast Wednesdays on Urbana Public Television Comcast Channel 6, which this is on Wednesday nights. The television version is streamed live at urbanapublictelevision.org. And also on Sundays, this Sunday and every Sunday, is Labor's Worldview TV. And this week, excited to announce that we'll be showing Robert Greenwald's new film, Unmanned America's Drone Wars. This film was just released, and the filmmaker, Robert Greenwald, made it available online for a limited time. So we were lucky at Labor's Worldview TV to download that, and we'll be showing that. That's we'll be showing this Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. on Urbana Public Television Comcast Channel 6. Yes, Bob?
A couple more of our underwriters here, Dave. The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the Illinois Education Association Union. The Illinois Education Association's mission is to effect excellence and equity in public education and to be the advocacy organization for all public education employees.
Okay, thank you, Bob. We're going to take a quick music break, and then we'll be talking with our special guest, Professor Dan Gilbert, who will be talking about his new book. In the meantime, you're listening to the World Labor Hour on WFT Listener Supported Community Radio Station, broadcasting from Champaign, Illinois, and web streaming live worldwide at WEFT.org. This is Ann Feeney, and we'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
Okay, that was Ann Feeney, Whatever Happened to the 8-Hour Day. Okay, I'm proud to be here with Professor Dan Gilbert. Dan, welcome back to World Labor Hour.
Thanks so much for having me back. It's great to be here.
Yeah, last time you were here, you brought your guitar and sang some labor songs that you composed, which were very excellent, very excellent.
Oh, thanks so much, David.
But today, you're here talking about your new book called Expanding the Strike Zone, Baseball in the Age of Free Agency. And just to let everybody know, Dan Gilbert's an assistant professor in the labor education program at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. And you grew up and went to school in Rhode Island?
Yeah, I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island. Great old industrial city on the East Coast. And
did you know any Coyas?
As an Arthur Coya?
Yeah, Arthur Coya, the former... I guess he's president emeritus since he had to give it up after...
His felony conviction.
No conviction. Left it within the union, but okay. It was over tax evasion.
Mm-hmm.
A Ferrari.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. our paths never crossed.
Okay.
Better or worse.
Okay. Let me just ask you, what kind of motivated you to write this book?
Well, I grew up being a baseball fan and always loved the Boston Red Sox. So I'm sorry to say that in front of any or into the ears of any Cardinals fans who may be listening or maybe in the room.
Cardinals or Cubs, it's kind of a border area
right,
here.
But, you know, then you know, I was lucky enough to get to go to graduate school and get to write a dissertation. And when I was sort of looking around for what to write about, I got really interested in the baseball industry as this kind of weird international industry with a kind of unique geography spanning the Americas and East Asia.
Where in Asia is it? Japan? I'm familiar with.
Yeah, so since the 1870s, 1880s, folks have been playing baseball in Japan, and then Japan's imperial presence in the Pacific then diffused baseball to places like Korea.
Oh,
aren't they like the big rival for the World Little League Championship or something?
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah. Sure. Since the 50s when we've had these, you know, kind of remarkable
the influence of American empire, basically.
Yeah.
And that's why people play basketball in some like Central American countries, and they don't generally in other places, right?
There is this relationship between sort of U.S. Power and the U.S. military and baseball's diffusion around the world. But really one of the things that interested me in writing the book was the ways in which other folks from other countries actually were some of the most important transmitters and sort of diffusers of baseball. So teachers and students in Japan, but also students in Cuba in the 1860s, just a couple decades after the first sort of formal organized baseball teams and leagues in the United States, elite Cuban students who come to school in the U.S. bring baseball back with them to Cuba. And in that period of Cuban nationalism and the war against the Spanish, the baseball becomes a form of Cuban national culture.
Folks are
playing baseball in Cuba to express a kind of Cuban identity that's different from the Spanish, that's different from bullfighting. Mm. So baseball really early on becomes a Cuban national pastime. And then it's Cubans who are spreading baseball throughout the Caribbean. The baseball first gets played in the Dominican Republic through the influence of Cubans who are fleeing Cuba during the 10 Years' War. So there's this sort of fascinating history.
The 10 Years' War.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that term either. Is that like the Spanish-American War? Before the Spanish-American War. Okay.
Yeah, this is late 1860s.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So the history of baseball in places like the Dominican Republic, places like Nicaragua, is a kind of joint history of local folks taking up the game, and then the kind of continued presence of the U.S. military kind of reinforcing that.
Well, that's correct. I mean, a lot of people don't realize this, but the United States Marines occupied Nicaragua through the 1920s, I believe.
That's 30s, right. Actually.
I thought it was the 20s.
Well, maybe if it was late 20s, so we'll have to look that up.
I got Google.
Okay, well, Google me this. Okay.
And so Somoza, the Nicaraguan dictator, you know, studied in Philadelphia and comes back to Nicaragua as a sort of great baseball fan. And he's one of these figures in Nicaragua who then is sort of obsessed with baseball and then uses baseball. And then the subsequent Somozas, the longstanding dictatorship in Nicaragua, will use baseball as a kind of form of Nicaraguan national culture.
Okay. Actually, there was a presence there from 1912 to 1933. Real quickly, there was a conflict and nominal force from 1912 to 1925. Then what they're calling the second occupation from 1926 to 1933. That's just the quick blurb Google gives you of a Wikipedia page.
Okay.
So we're both right, Dave.
Okay. All right.
We're both wrong.
Okay, whatever. So now, as far as when did the baseball players in the United States start to unionize? I didn't realize baseball, frankly, went back that far to, 1840s, basically.
Yeah.
Wow.
And there are a number of attempts over the years to organize. There are attempts at players' leagues in the late 19th century. What continues today as the Major League Baseball Players Association, the union that represents Major League ball players, has its roots in a failed organizing drive in 1946, right after World War II. There was a labor attorney out of Boston named Robert Murphy who tried to organize something called the American Baseball Guild. He was going to go city by city and organize ball players. So he started in Pittsburgh because it was such a great union town. That drive failed, but the team owners were so freaked out about the idea of their employees organizing that they created essentially a kind of company union. It was this association that, a representative from each team got to meet with the owners once or twice a year. That structure then, in the mid-1960s, became the basis for reorganization into an actual union. And the ball players at that time were really concerned about their pensions. They felt like the team owners were making a pile of money out of television broadcasting and not sharing that revenue appropriately into the players' pension plan. And so the players hired this guy Marvin Miller, who had been the chief economist of the United Steelworkers, had been a sort of key figure in the Steelworkers union during some of those major collective bargaining fights of the 1950s, the 1959 National Steel Strike, for example. And this guy Miller comes in to the Ball Players Association and actually knows something about how to organize and what a union actually does. And it's really almost by accident that the baseball players hired this guy. But over the next 10 years, from 1966 to 1976, Miller helped the baseball players organize themselves into a remarkably successful union, winning sort of extraordinary gains in wages and benefits and winning a new system of free agency where for the first time players were able to go out and get competing offers from other clubs. Up until the mid-70s, once a player was signed with a major league team, he was essentially that team's property for as long as the team wanted to keep them around. So there was a famous case of the St. Louis Cardinals center fielder Kurt Flood, who after the 1969 season was traded to the Philadelphia Phillies. Flood was one of the great African American stars of the Cardinals during the 1960s and had built a career, built a life in St. Louis, and he said, "I don't want to go. I don't want to be traded to Philadelphia. I've made my career here. I deserve the right to be able to make decisions about my own professional future." And so he ended up suing Major League Baseball. A case went to the Supreme Court. He lost that case, but his sort of public fight against the sort of old labor regime of Major League Baseball became a major cause and a major kind of rallying point for the players' union. Eventually, they won free agency in the mid-70s through an arbitration case.
Okay.
I was wondering about this. Like, this all deals with contracts, right? Like, he signed a contract that said that they could trade that contract, basically. Yeah. So, sort of like, I don't know, it was just sort of a situation. I was kind of thinking at the same time about musicians as how they'll sign contracts with recording companies They don't necessarily, I've never heard of anybody being traded, more or less. But were the players at that time considered sort of independent contractors, or were they more, or were they considered really employees, or was there just never really any thought to, given to it?
They were employees, but extremely powerless and exploited employees, in the sense that the major contractual sort of mechanism that this whole system depended upon was called the reserve clause. And so in every player's contract was a clause that said, if, you know, after the expiration of this contract, the two sides can't agree on new terms, these terms will renew again for another year.
Oh, okay.
And so, you know, the players had very little, they could hold out on their contract. You know, they could, you know, so if a star like Mickey Mantle could say, I'm not going to show up to spring training unless the Yankees pony up some more money. But, you know, if you're a utility infielder just struggling to, you know, you don't want to, you know, just kind of continue to make a living in baseball, you don't have any leverage to hold out on your contract. And so this arbitration case in late 75 found that clause, which had always been interpreted in practice in the baseball industry as meaning that the player was the team's property in perpetuity, the arbitrator held that actually it just meant that the player's contract renewed for one more year. And so if a player played out what was called playing out your option, you would then become a free agent. And then once that sort of ruling came down, the owners were kind of forced to negotiate this whole new system called free agents.
Okay. And I know the average lifetime of a national, you know, professional football player is about 3 years. What's the average career of a professional baseball player?
It's longer in baseball. That's a great question, David. I don't know off the top of my head what the average.
But it's longer than 3 years, I would take, just because it's not quite the most dangerous and of the sport.
Longer than three. And you know, this is one of the reasons I think we can say pretty definitively that the football players have had a harder time gaining the kind of power in their industry that the baseball players have. That if you're a professional football player looking at, you know, a career of a couple years, you are much less, you know, likely to take the kinds of militant steps going out on strike that the baseball players had to do to win such a and build such a powerful union.
Okay. Now, you mentioned your book as far as, you know, in terms of scouting. I mean, the things that basically changes within the industry and the sport itself. You mentioned, besides the rise of unionism, about the changes in scouting and stadium development. Could you talk a little bit about that? Now, as far as the Latin American aspect, I'd kind of like to save that, you know, and I don't know if you had that included under your scouting segment or not, but I definitely would like to talk about that at some point whenever you think it's appropriate.
Yeah. So the book is it's called Baseball in the Age of Free Agency, and it's largely a story of the ways in which the industry changes after the Major League Baseball Players Union wins these new forms of power. And so one of the ways in which the industry changes is teams start to look for new sources of cheap talent.
Okay. And when did this start? Back in the 70s, in the mid-70s? Because that's when you said they pretty much formed a union.
Yeah, so
once the country.
Once the players kind of achieve this new system of free agency in the mid-70s, we see a whole sort of series of changes in baseball. And one of those changes that I write about in the book is a sort of new forms of international scouting. There had long been, Major League Baseball teams had for years scouted players from other countries, particularly Latin American countries. But beginning in the 70s and then really taking off in the 80s and 90s, teams invested in a new system of Latin American scouting centered in what are called the baseball academies, and in particular in the Dominican Republic. They've been playing baseball in the Dominican Republic since the late 19th century, and as I said, Major League teams had scouts there for a long time. But in the late 70s and 80s, as teams are looking for new sources of cheap young talent, they develop these things called baseball academies, in which teams are able to cheaply and efficiently train, first try out train, sign young players for very little money, particularly early on. And in some ways, I think we can see the Dominican Baseball Academy system as kind of the baseball industry's version of export processing.
Okay.
You know, if folks are familiar with the sort of broader labor history of the Caribbean over the last three or four decades, the history of the transformation of the Dominican economy into an economy based on tourism and free trade zones, these baseball academies, which are run by these kinds of multinational corporations called baseball teams, they're not exporting cheap textiles. They're exporting cheap ball players.
Where are baseballs made now?
Baseballs. The history of baseball manufacturing is a very interesting one. There was a period in the, I believe, the late 70s, early 80s, when baseballs were made in Haiti, actually. Mm-hmm. And so as the Major League Baseball academy system is taking off in the Dominican Republic, on that same island of Hispaniola, the in Haiti, where folks don't play baseball, the baseballs were being manufactured. That production shifted to Costa Rica at a certain point, I believe, in the 80s or 90s. I suspect that the baseball used in Major League Baseball games are currently manufactured in China.
Well, okay. Still make bats in Louisville?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's a surprise there.
And, maybe you guys know more about this. Up on 74 in Rantoul, there's a big the new plant is an Easton plant, I believe.
Not familiar with it.
We should look into this more, but I was just driving up to Chicago a couple days ago, and I saw a big Easton sign on this new plant that's right to the west of 74 in Rantoul. And Easton is they make aluminum bats, among other things, sporting goods manufacturer.
Okay. Was that company that made, hurdles and stuff in town here?
Oh,
God, I can't remember that. Yeah, shoot.
Okay, I guess we have.
But I mean, they're the major company that makes stuff like that.
Yeah,
and they used to be there on Cunningham.
Okay, we have a question, I guess, from a caller.
Yeah, that's great. A caller wants to know about the influence of cricket on the evolution of baseball.
Oh, interesting question.
It's a really interesting question. And baseball first evolved out of kind of a whole host of bat and ball games out of the British sporting tradition, of which cricket is clearly the most important and longest lasting. So some of those early baseball teams in the United States were teams of folks who grew up playing cricket, and some of the early champions of baseball as America's national pastime around the turn of the 20th century and the decades leading up to the turn of the 20th century went to great lengths to define baseball as this thing that was sort of more manly and more purely American than the old British form of cricket. So there's that story, but then there's also the story of baseball's development in the Caribbean, and indeed some of the early baseball players in places like the Dominican Republic are sugar workers who come to the Dominican Republic from other locations in the Caribbean where, through the influence of the British Empire, they and their parents and grandparents grew up playing cricket. So baseball and cricket do stand in this sort of interesting relationship in its international history.
Well, I have an update here on the Easton Bell Sports place there in Rantoul. This is from August 14th, 2012, and basically they've put in a distribution center out there west of Rantoul, Illinois, out there probably by the Eagle Wings plant. There's a lot of sort of big industrial park area there right off of, 136 and 74. And that's right. And the company I was trying to think of that was local that made the track and field equipment is Gill Athletics.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I always thought that was because that's I've never seen anything but Gill stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's because I'm always in the Midwest or what.
But. Okay. Two other themes you hit on your book, Dan, are broadcasting and stadium development. And I like kind of talk about stadium development first because, you know, it's interesting. Baseball originally was like an urban working class sport. I mean, it was relatively inexpensive to attend. A lot of working class people were the fans that went to the stadiums. I've only been into two baseball games in my life. Once at St. Louis, the Cardinal game in the early 70s when I was a kid, and once in the late 60s when I was a really young kid up at Chicago for the White Sox. Mm-hmm. And I just have to say, it just really disgusts me to see these stadiums now with corporate company names on them as opposed to, say, a local historical figure or politician, at least. You know, I don't know. I know politicians are bad, too, but I don't know.
Instead of a local land developer or something.
Yeah, now it's sell your one field instead of Kaminsky Park, for instance, you know. So I don't know if that's kind of what some of the things you mention or just... Okay.
So, one of the chapters in the book is the story of baseball in Seattle, which is I think a fascinating story, and it's largely about this question of you know what has been the relationship of these places, these corporate places that Major League Baseball teams own and run and profit from, and the cities in which they operate. And in Seattle, there's really been a fascinating, important, undertold history of social movement, community organizing against baseball stadium development. In the early 1970s, when Seattle was in the process of getting the Seattle Mariners, in order to get that franchise, the city was compelled to build a stadium for the Mariners to play, and also for the Seattle Seahawks, the football team, to use. And that was the Kingdom, built with public money, and it was located directly adjacent to a working class Asian American community called the International District. So in the early 70s, as these plans are unfolding and the city is getting ready to break ground on the Kingdom, this extraordinary social movement emerges, sort of a coalition of new left generation student activists from the University of Washington and folks of their parents and grandparents' generation who live in the International District, folks who are active in or retirees from the cannery workers union based in that neighborhood, folks who would work in the fisheries. And that movement of that sort of intergenerational Asian American movement that emerges in the International District to fight development of the Kingdom doesn't ultimately succeed in stopping stadium construction, but does go on to really shape that neighborhood into this remarkable community that continues to thrive today as a center for of the Asian American community in that city, and then more recently the Mariners, like many professional sports teams, have done threatened to leave Seattle unless the city built them a new stadium.
Mm-hmm.
The Kingdom opened in 1976 in the late 90s. You know, 20 years later, they say we're gonna move to Florida or some other location unless you build us a new stadium. And so, in the late 1990s, a new ballpark, Safeco Field, opened again adjacent to this.
Safeco.
Name for the insurance.
That's my insurance. Yeah. Okay.
And so that transformation from the Kingdom, you know, named for King County, yeah. Where
I get to help pay for that, don't
yeah,
I?
Sure. Yeah, sure. The team sold the naming rights to Safeco Insurance Company for $40 million, I believe. So wow. That transformation from the stadium, you know, named for the county,
mm-hmm.
county to a stadium named for an insurance company, you know, I think, you know, going back to your question, David, I think is a kind of it's an I see it as a kind of emblem for the sort of increasing place of corporations in, you know, the sort of public and quasi-public spaces in our cities and towns.
And the cost of tickets. I mean, it's like it used to be quite affordable for a family to go to a baseball game, you know, and now it's like, I mean, just from what I've heard from various people that do go occasionally, it's outrageous. I mean, well, most working class people can't afford it, you know.
Look at rock concerts now.
Well, but you baseball know. Has really gone up. I know rock concerts have
rock concerts are easily, for any decency, well over $100 a ticket.
Boy, that shows you how long I have gone. Okay. Wow. So, yeah, so basically now, instead of having, I mean, not to say a working class person, you know, if they're a real big fan, can't save up and go to one game with their family and stuff, but sure. Nothing like in the old days where it wouldn't think anything of it, going, you know, maybe almost every time there was a game almost. So now you got a different type of people that to go to these games, and also now there's the whole emergence of the, what are they, the sky boxes or whatever, where people can pay a premium and sit up there. I mean, I don't know if you touch on this in the book or not, but it just seems like it's a further corporatization of the sport.
Certainly. So one of the major trends in ballpark construction over the last couple decades has been this phenomenon of what are called retro ballparks. These ballparks that have these sort of architectural gestures toward places like Wrigley Field and Chicago, Fenway Park, and Boston, places that sort of look like, you know, they might belong or you know, make some reference to the old industrial cities of the teens and 20s, but are built with sort of corporate clientele in mind. So built with lots of luxury seating, big corporate boxes, club seats that you know, are sold to corporate season ticket holders that are closer to the field than the sort of than the box, than the sort of luxury boxes higher up. So yes, you know, clearly baseball, the sort of live experience of baseball at the park has become increasingly corporatized, and in many cases has been you know, priced out of the range of working class audiences. I think that's, you know, it's a slightly more nuanced story as you go around the country. I think, you know, in some places, Kansas City, for example, it remains very cheap to go see the Royals play.
Really? Okay. Okay.
A lot cheaper than it is to go see the Yankees play in the Bronx.
Okay.
You know, some of those disparities between the sort of differences between franchises have been the driving forces in the baseball industry over the last couple of decades. The ability of teams like the Yankees and the Dodgers and the Cubs to make piles of money through local cable television deals that allow them to go out and sign more expensive free agents than say teams like the Minnesota Twins and the Kansas City Royals.
So there's no baseball equivalent of like the Green Bay Packers, where Green Bay, the city of Green Bay, actually owns the stadium as opposed to a corporate entity.
There isn't, not in Major League Baseball.
That's too bad. Because when was it the Brooklyn Dodgers? Originally, it was the Brooklyn Dodgers. What year did they move out to California, to LA? I think it was.
So the Dodgers and their New York National League counterparts, the Giants, left New York after the 1957 season.
Started that early. Okay.
Debuted as the LA Dodgers and the San Francisco Giants in 1958. And then a few years later, the New York Mets were created as an expansion franchise that were intended to capture the old fan bases of the Dodgers and Giants in New York City.
Okay, all right. Well, Dan, I'm afraid we ran out of time, but I just wanted to let all the listeners know that we've been talking to Professor Dan Gilbert, who's a professor at the Labor Institute at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, talking about his new book, Expanding the Strike Zone, Baseball in the Age of Free Agency. How can people find out more about your book, and also how to purchase it if they'd like?
Well, thanks so much for asking. They can find the book at their favorite online retailer. Powell's.com, for example, is a good progressive bookstore, independent bookstore with a good website. You can also get it on Amazon. You can also order it locally at, you know, maybe stocked at some of the local bookstores, but you could certainly.